Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the definition of the average American changing? We're just over 5 years away from the next census, and experts believe 40% of us will identify ourselves as minorities when we fill it out. By 2050, it's likely that no single ethnic or racial group will make up a majority of the U.S. population, a fact that will coincide with big shifts in geographic voting patterns, racial integration at the neighborhood level, and a robust supply of young people to fill the demands of the labor market as other developed countries begin to struggle with recruiting. William H. Fry is senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and research professor in population studies at the University of Michigan. His new book is called Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Bill, welcome to Think.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really pleased to be here, Chris.
So you look at this stuff all the time. How is it that the 2010 census took even you by surprise?
I really was taken aback by the 2010 census, and you know, I call the book Diversity Explosion not to scare anybody, but to just to put an exclamation point on what I saw in the 2010 census. We all knew that we're minorities in the United States were growing, you know, especially in Texas. Folks know that probably better than anywhere else in the United States, and I also was keeping track of all that as well. But in addition, what I actually saw was the slow growth, and for some age groups, a decline in the nation's white population, which I wasn't expecting to see. It's the white population, the Anglo population in the United States is a lot older. It's a median age of 42 compared to 37 for the U.S. and 27 for Hispanics. As part of that, it means there are fewer women in their childbearing ages, so that the fertility is generally lower in general. What we saw between 2000 and 2010 for the nation and in 46 states, there was an actual decline in the white child population, the people under age 18. There were fewer whites under age 18 in 2010 than there were in 2000. And, of course, that has huge impacts and implications for the future of our youth, not only our youth, but our younger labor force. So it really puts in perspective why the growth of these new minorities, because they're a younger population and have somewhat higher fertility, not because they have lots and lots of kids, but there's just more women in their childbearing ages. It's important why we have that growth. And so the juxtaposition of those two things, the aging and slow growth, and in some cases decline of the white population, with this continued growth of new minorities, including Hispanics and Asians and multiracial people, as well as blacks, and other minorities as well. That juxtaposition, I think, is what really hit me and really, I think, goaded me to write this book.
And to be clear, what's driving growth in what you call the new minorities, and in particular, multiracial people and Latinos and Asians? It's not so much driven by people moving to this country. It's driven by people who are already here having children.
That's right. This is the case for Hispanics, and because Hispanics are such a big part of the minority population, it makes it the case for the entire minority population together. That is, up until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, it was immigration that was the biggest driver of Hispanic growth in the United States. But now there's enough, Hispanics living in the United States, U.S. resident Hispanics, that even having just a little bit of above average fertility gives them that engine for growth makes it a bigger contribution than immigration. So going forward, irrespective of what our immigration policy happens to be, I mean, we're going to just become a more diverse country. Now, for the Asian population, that's a much newer immigrant group, and the lion's share of the growth in the Asian population is still from immigration. But since Hispanics make up such a big part of the minority population, the fact that they're now beginning to grow largely from what demographers call natural increase, that means more births than deaths, then through immigration. This means that we're on track to become a more diverse nation no matter what happens to immigration.
You point to an important milestone in 2011 when, for the first time since the founding of the political entity that is the United States, more minority babies were born here than white babies. Can you talk about why that was such a watershed moment?
Well, you know, I think what it means is it's a beginning of the transformation of the whole population as those young people start aging. You know, the Census Bureau's projections show that by 2020, most of the people under age 18 are going to be minorities in the United States. By something like 2027, most of the 20-somethings in the United States are going to be minorities. So that's going to just keep bubbling up, that minority cohort. You know, I like to think of this new minority and diversity explosion that we're experiencing now as sort of a parallel diversity boom in the first half of this century that's comparable to the baby boom in the last half of the 20th century. And, of course, we all know the baby boom had huge impacts in all kinds of ways in our country, not just because the baby boomers were such a large size, but they're very different. Even today as seniors, baby boomers are different. You know, they were the Woodstock generation. They did all kinds of changes the way women's roles were, the way families were changed. And, you know, I think there'll be similar kinds of shifts that will go on in our population as these new minorities continue to be a big force and continue to sort of grow and age and be a bigger part of our whole population this century.
If the aging and slow population growth of the white population in this country were not countered by the rise in minority populations, what impact would that have on our prospects for economic growth?
Well, you know, I think to the extent our economic growth is tied to a growth in our labor force, tied to, you know, a growing consumer population, especially in the younger ages, you know, and also being able to balance a budget at the federal level that has to pay out Social Security to an older part of the population, which depends on contributions by the younger part of the population, that all of those things and probably many others would be in trouble. And, you know, there are countries like that. Japan has a very old population. It doesn't have very much immigration. And because it's an old population, the fertility rate is very low. And there are several countries in Europe like Italy and Germany that are in that situation. And they're facing those kinds of issues. You know, we, on the other hand, have the bonus, I guess, is to being able to attract a lot of new minorities, especially Hispanics and Asians, as, you know, as immigrants in the last two, three decades or so. But now we have that sort of critical mass that they're now a big part of our population, and they'll continue to grow just by being here. And it will help us increase our labor force rather than reduce our labor force. It'll make that young population, which is you know, going to be consuming a lot, grow rather than shrink. And so, you know, I think this is important, but there's a big if here. And the big if is we need to make sure that these young people are well prepared to enter the labor force and be productive, which means doing things to make sure that their education is appropriate for the kinds of jobs that are going to be opening up. And, you know, we provide a lot of the other social benefits that to make these young people much more productive in the future. But we have that opportunity where a lot of other countries don't have that opportunity because they don't have this growing young population.
For the first time this year, the balance of public school students in the United States was more minority than white. And, of course, that's been the case in a lot of big cities and small cities in places like Texas for a long time. Do you feel like both the successes and the failures of urban, very diverse school districts will provide a model for the way forward for the rest of the country?
Well, I think the fact that we have diverse school districts, many of them that are succeeding very well at what they're doing, is an appropriate, important contribution to our future, if only because we have people who have different backgrounds and come from different nationalities, sometimes can speak 2-3 languages, and also be prepared, you know, from an education standpoint to take the kinds of jobs that are going to be available. I think that's a real plus in this country. And so this is an advantage. Of course, there are school systems that aren't doing as well. They're strapped for funds. And, you know, I think this is kind of an issue that needs to be raised nationally to make sure that this this younger generation is given everything that they can be given to succeed.
So you mentioned that the population growth among the Hispanic or Latino population is particularly pronounced. Are those individuals like having more children per family when they're in their childbearing years, or are there just a lot more of them in their childbearing years right now than other populations?
You know, the main reason we see a lot of Latino kids is because there's a bigger percentage of the women in their prime childbearing years in the Latino population, which is a much younger population than the white population or the population as a whole. Demographers have this thing called the total fertility rate. It's a sort of arcane term. And it kind of means, you know, how many children are you going to have per woman? And if that, from a statistical standpoint, if it's higher than 2.1, it means that that population will essentially replace itself over time. If it's below 2.1 children per woman, it won't replace itself. Latino fertility rate has been coming down over time. And some of the recent numbers that have come out have it, you know, just a little bit above replacement level. It used to be a lot above replacement level. So it's not wildly high fertility among the Latino population. Most of the reason we have the natural increase in Hispanics in the United States is mostly because there's a large number of women in their childbearing years.
Bill, obviously there are interesting questions about personal identity for people who identify themselves as multiracial, but I wonder from the perspective of a demographer, certainly you can classify people as multiracial or multiethnic, but are they in a sort of separate category, and how are demographers learning to deal with people who identify as multiracial, and do they belong in a separate category? Do they, you know, have a leg in two different categories?
Well, this is a big challenge to be able to classify people in an ever-fluid way of self-identification in the United States. You know, it really is, because as soon as government agencies, private sector folks who put together classification schemes together and implement them, things change even more. They can't really keep up with it. I mean, right now the Census Bureau and most government agencies allow you to identify yourself with more than one race. You know, white, black, Asian, and American Indian, Alaska Natives. But formally speaking, the government doesn't consider Hispanics as a racial group. So the multiracial classification numbers that you see coming out of the Census Bureau don't consider Hispanics and whites as a multiracial group. I, in my book, do consider Hispanics, you know, it's a fine line in what you want to call a race versus an ethnic classification. But for the most part in our country, when we think of Hispanics, we see them as kind of in the same light as other racial groups. And I think most people think of racial groups as a cultural group rather than, you know, something biological. And when you do it that way, there's a lot more multiracial people in the United States than if you do the statistics that the Census Bureau does. But even so, and I do think the Census Bureau is talking about changing the way they deal with this to include Hispanics in their multiracial categories. Even so, I don't think there's an easy way to predict, given all of the interracial marriages we see, not only between, say, Hispanics and Anglos, but between different nationalities of Hispanics with other nationalities of Hispanics, of people to think about how they self-identify themselves. I think it's going to be very fluid. And, you know, when you see this figure that says by 2044 or 2050, whites are going to be in the minority of the population, I think when we get there, that classification of white might be non-existent. There'll be so many other kinds of categories to deal with.
William H. Fry is my guest. He's senior fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and research professor in population studies at the University of Michigan. His new book is called Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with William H. Fry, Senior Fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Bill, I was really fascinated by all of the research about changes in domestic migration, people moving from one part of the country to another, not least of which is this trend that looks to potentially reverse the effects of the great migration of African Americans from the South to cities in the North.
Yes, that's right. You know, people who study the history of African-American migration, black migration in the United States, will know that, you know, for a good part of the 20th century, there was a great migration out of the South. People left because the economy wasn't good. They left because of discriminatory practices in the South, but also because there were lots of jobs opening up in northern cities, cities like Chicago or New York or Detroit. And so, you know, between 1910 and essentially 1970, even a little bit of a downturn during the war and the Depression, but after the war, after World War II again, there continued to be a lot of movement out of the South. And but beginning around 1970, of course, you know, the South, the post-war South, became much more prosperous than it ever had been before. And whites started moving to the South a lot earlier. But beginning about 1970. With all the deindustrialization, the turndown of jobs in northern cities, and some really kind of nasty race relations and riots and so forth in northern cities, blacks started moving back to the South. But during the 1970s and 1980s, that movement back to the South was more of a push from the North rather than a pull to the South. But for the last 20 or 25 years, there's really been a draw, an economic draw, for lots of people to come to the South, but particularly for African Americans. They tended to, when they considered all the other regional destinations that might be prosperous, there's been work on this, they're much more likely to select a southern destination than, say, whites would be similarly situated in the North. And, of course, the very prosperous parts of the South gain most of the African Americans, Texas being one of them, Georgia being another, North Carolina, Florida, but several other southern states are really big draws. And so what I found and what I write about in the book is that, you know, all segments of the black population are part of this, but it's particularly accentuated for college graduate blacks, for younger blacks, and for retiring blacks. So I foresee that, you know, as the baby boomers start retiring, continue to retire over the next decade or two, there'll be even more older blacks moving to the South. And what it's doing is helping to cement the idea that the South is a largely white black region. Now, Texas is an exception to that because of the large Latino population. Florida is an exception, but most of the other southern states, the black population is bigger than the Hispanic population, and it's continuing to grow.
So if white Americans built the suburbs and the cultures that we associate with the suburbs, they are no longer the sort of sole owners of these places. They've been joined first by Asians, then by Latinos, and now in greater numbers than ever by African Americans.
Yes, I have a chapter called Melting Pot Cities and Melting Pot Suburbs. Now we're talking about the suburbs as being melting pot areas in the United States. You know, the old image of white flight to the suburbs, that's an old idea when you look at the numbers that are coming out. And in fact, not in Texas, but if you look at the whole U.S. population and all of the large metropolitan areas, about a third of them are actually showing declines in their suburban white populations. You know, most of these, of course, are in the states that aren't growing very rapidly at all anyway. But it really tells you the fact that the white flight is kind of petered out in a lot of places. And what's really, really the draw is, you know, Asians had a bigger suburbanization first, Hispanics followed, although they have much bigger numbers and are now probably the biggest contributor to suburban growth in a lot of places. And then in this last decade, a fairly pervasive suburbanization of African Americans. That's the newest one. And, you know, if you look at the 10 cities, the inner cities that have the largest black populations, nine of them showed absolute losses in their black populations because of black suburbanization. So, you know, the suburbs has really become becoming a kaleidoscope, and those old stereotypes about white suburbs just don't apply anymore.
Are the suburbs fully diverse, or are people settling in pockets among those who sort of come from similar cultural backgrounds?
Yeah, it's true that, you know, we don't have kind of a homogeneous suburban population so that you can say every part of the suburbs has that same racial composition. It's like everything else in America. People do gravitate to certain pockets, and a lot of it is by race. So the racial segregation, which we still have a lot of in the United States, especially in cities, especially in older cities in the United States, that also shows up in different suburban areas as well. But it's not quite as high as the segregation that's in cities. And, you know, when you look at all of the different ethnic groups, racial groups that move to the suburbs, the people who are leading the way to the suburbanization tend to be those that are more educated, have higher incomes, more likely to have families with kids. After all, that was the main reason a lot of people moved to the suburbs for decades and decades. They moved to the suburbs because they had better schools, typically, and when people started to have kids, they headed off to the suburbs. That was the case for white families for a long time. Now it's the case for racial minorities. So, you know, it's a different somewhat population than the city population, but there are these pockets there, and, you know, that will probably change over time as they disperse to other parts of the suburbs.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now and speak with Ken in Fort Worth. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Sure, because I'm sort of a product of this. I just moved from Atlanta and was able to sell my house very quickly because there's an influx of retirees from the Rust Belt, retirees of color. And so my house sold very quickly, so I was able to move, leave the city. But the thing that I'm really calling about is that every time I hear the term majority-minority, I cringe. As these demographics change, we're going to have to find new language to have these discussions.
What do you think about that, Bill? Thanks so much for your call, Ken.
I think it's a fair point. I mean, people now have gotten so used to saying it that it's gotten life of its own. But I think you know, it's absolutely fair to say that, you know, if no group is in the majority numerically, you know, we just have to call it something else. And I think people in Texas should know this better than anywhere else because the race, what we used to think of or continue to think of as racial minorities, now outnumber the Anglos and have been for a while in Texas and several other parts of the country. So it is an antiquated expression, but like a lot of other expressions that people cling on to. They kind of know what it means. The media like it. They keep, you know, recycling it. It may continue to have a life of its own. But I agree with that comment.
You think if a new term arises, it will probably come from academia?
No, I don't think so. Someone who's been in academia for most of my life, somehow academic terms don't tend to spill out to the rest of the country. I think probably it'll come from just general people who wind up using it, and maybe the media will pick it up, and that'll be the way it goes.
To the extent that in, you know, pretty diverse cities and suburbs, there are still pockets where, you know, people live and sort of look like their neighbors. Is it possible to tease out whether that segregation is entirely a product of race and ethnicity, or if it has something to do with socioeconomic class?
Well, that's an interesting question, and there's lots of books and studies and dissertations trying to tease that particular question out. I mean, it has been for most of the history of this country, unfortunately, that race has been an important part of segregation, especially black-white segregation. Even if you know, take into account income and family type and lots of other things, for a long time it had been the case that the most educated and the most well-off African Americans were more segregated from whites than the most well-off, more segregated from whites of their same socioeconomic status than other groups are. So that didn't put you in the same neighborhood as a white, just having that income, just having that education. That's broken down a little bit over the last several decades, so that now, you know, as someone of color earns a good income, becomes a professional, certainly able to buy a home anywhere they want to. So the segregation levels are breaking down. But for a long time, race was much more important. It's still more important for the most part. I think there are places where you could say that the income and other attributes, you know, are becoming just as important. But, you know, this is still part of our history, part of our legacy. This is not as much the case for the Asian population or even the Hispanic population, but the black-white segregation in this country, due to some many decades of horrible practices and horrible laws, and even in the decades since the civil rights movement, is still pretty high. And although it's declining, and it's declining fairly pervasively, not by a lot, but broadly, it's declining pervasively. And that's one of the things I do write about in the book, that I think will continue, especially as the younger generation comes along and has different practices and different appetites for who they want to live with. And I think it's part of this black suburbanization that we started to see in the last census. I think that's a step in the right direction.
Does your research offer any clues as to why younger people, by and large, and I'm generalizing here, tend to be more comfortable with living in diverse areas than older people, by and large?
You know, I can only speculate from, you know, what I see on the street and what I read about in, you know, both the academic and the popular literature. All of the surveys show that younger people are much more open to, say, multiracial marriage, to multiracial living. And, you know, I think it stems from the fact that right now we have almost a majority minority of young people, or I use that term again. But we almost have, you know, a situation where there are more people of color than people of white in the younger part of the population. These are the people they tend to see in their classes in school. These are the people who they interact with in their local communities. I think the internet is a big part of all this. You can get to see people and communicate with people and all over the place, all over the world, something that young people in the past or today's older people weren't doing when they were younger. So I think all of that helps to make people a lot more open. And that's why I'm encouraged about where we're going as a country, because I write in the book about something I call a cultural generation gap. That's a fancy term, but what it means is that when you ask the older people in the population, who are mostly white and for whom the major racial minority group are blacks, not Hispanics, you ask those older, primarily white older people about, you know, how accepting they are to people coming in here from other countries, how accepting they are to new minorities. And they're not quite as open as you might expect them to be to these things. And it spills over to the way they vote for their acceptance of maybe increasing government spending for the kinds of programs that would help young people, like schools, medical care, and that sort of thing. Whereas if you ask those same questions to younger people, even younger white people, they're much more open to the new America.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Charles in Cedar Hill. Hi, Charles.
How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Excellent show. I listen to you all the time.
Thanks.
To keep my pulse, or keep my finger on the pulse, that is, of Texas and, I guess, America writ large. My question is, given the, demographics as a science, and it's helping to explain and describe the social fabric of our nation, I wonder what the guest's thoughts would be in terms of the, well, arguably the failure of African-American acceptance socially. And it may be in context with the coming increase in Hispanic population, when that the science can help to integrate, which term I hate, Hispanics into the overall fabric. And I agree with the previous caller about the majority-minority is a ridiculous phrase.
Well, thanks for your call, Charles. Bill, what do you want to say to all that?
Well, you know, this has been a gradual process. And you know, as a caller knows, as most listeners know, race and discrimination against blacks and other racial groups is a kind of sorry part of our history, but one that needs to be looked at to understand the kind of continued discrimination we see in much more informal ways than we used to in the United States. I think a lot that the civil rights movement in the 1960s, the laws that were passed to outlaw discrimination in hiring and selling and renting of homes, and in other activities, public accommodation, being able to involve yourself in public accommodations. Several generations of people have passed through since the civil rights movement. I think, you know, I'd be the first to say that we haven't gotten anywhere close to what the dream was back then in terms of closing the inequality on income and so forth between the races. But we've made a lot of progress, and I think a lot of the younger population in the United States, people who grew up since the civil rights movement, both whites and minorities, you know, have come to accept more the idea of inclusion of racial groups than we've had before. And that shows up in surveys, and it shows up in the fact that we do have declines in residential segregation, although not as big and as much as we would like. It also shows up in interracial marriages. It turns out, I've looked at this in the book, and it's now about 1 in 8 marriages involving blacks are a black-white marriage. In 1967, black-white marriages were illegal in 16 states. You know, now, especially among young people, this is more common. But it's something that will occur slowly, and it has a lot to do with our very discriminatory past in the United States. But I do think the fact that we have more racial and ethnic minorities in the United States in addition to blacks makes it somewhat different than kind of just us versus them. We now have a kaleidoscope of people in the country, and I think that helps more acceptance on the part of everybody.
William H. Fry is my guest. He's research professor in population studies at the University of Michigan and author of the new book, Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with William H. Fry of the Brookings Institution and the University of Michigan about his new book, Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Bill, does a larger percentage of non-white Americans as an overall share of the population point toward greater support for the Democratic Party over time?
You know, I think that a lot of Democrats would like to think that because what we've seen is that in the last two presidential elections and many more before that for at least some of the minority groups, there's been a strong support by minorities for Democrats. You know, if that would continue, you know, as the white population got smaller, you would think that that would help a lot. But there's more goes into it than that, of course. Even at the presidential election level, it means that Democrats can't only look for support from minorities. There's still a large white population out there. And in the last presidential election, you know, Mr. Obama did very well among blacks and Hispanics and Asians. He didn't do very well at all for whites. And so It's a bit of a slippery slope if you wanted to count just on minorities for the votes. But I think the same goes for the Republican Party. They did very well among whites, but they didn't do very well at all among minorities. I think that kind of race identity strategy on the part of either party is going to break down over time. And the reason it's going to break down, I think, especially even in the presidential election, but even in other elections, is that the country breaks down into different regions and into different states that have different kinds of coalitions. And in the presidential election, we've seen that a lot of new minorities are moving into the Sun Belt. I think Texas is probably away from being a Democratic state in the presidential election, but Virginia and Nevada in the Sun Belt, and so North Carolina in 2008. Voted Democratic after a long time of voting Republican because of those minority groups moving into those states. At the same time, though, a lot of the older states, the blue states in the Northeast and the Midwest, states like Ohio or Pennsylvania, are still pretty white. And the Democrats took them both in the last couple of elections. But maybe not can't count on that all the time, because even though the white population is declining, for the country as a whole, it's still growing among the older population. In other words, as the white population ages, we see fewer whites in the younger population and the young adult population, but we still see a ballooning of the age 65 and over population among whites as those baby boomers move into those ages. And in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania, maybe Michigan, if there is that kind of racial split, those states may get more Republican support if it's still the case that older whites vote Republican. So it's a little bit complicated. It's not a straightforward answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Greg in Fort Worth. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess it's kind of backtracking, but I called when y'all were talking about the questions of the younger people being more comfortable and more accepting across racial and ethnic lines. And I think, I don't know how many of us there are, but a lot of us that grew up as kids during the 60s and watched the transformation of the country through the civil rights movement. We also saw, a judgment of how horrible it was in this country before the civil rights movement and how difficult that movement was. I think a lot of us tried to instill our ideals into our children. And, we probably didn't talk about there being so much of a divide as we knew it was important to be inclusive, even if our own generation maybe didn't really get it. But we could certainly try to pass it on. So I'd like to think there's a little bit of that went on.
You think that could be true, Bill? It's just bearing fruit, these different ideas that were raised and spread, particularly during the civil rights era?
Yeah, I think the caller is right. I think that, the civil rights movement has had a profound effect on the way we deal with race in the United States. As I said before, it hasn't solved all of the problems, and I think we need to continue to be vigilant about a lot of the legal protections that were put in place by the civil rights movement and make sure that they continue to be enforced and so forth. But I think, as your caller, he was a generation, he sounds like kind of my generation, grew up at a time when all this was happening, and it really was eye-opening, to see how things were going on in some parts of the country where there were these riots and very, very harsh treatment of blacks that somehow got a little bit alleviated by the laws of the civil rights movement. But I think more importantly, it changed people's ideas about, what race is in the United States and brought about a broad value of inclusiveness that I think people do instill in their children that I do think is a basic value we have in this country that we really didn't have back then, and in all parts of the country. And back then, maybe some parts of the country had it, maybe other parts didn't. But I think all parts of the country now are much more accepting. And so I very much agree with that.
Can you talk about the ways that our diverse and growing and relatively young population positions us better than other developed economies in more homogenous countries, particularly in Europe, which is sort of the region that we often compare ourselves to?
Yeah, I think this is something that has a demographic aspect to it, but also a historical aspect to it. The demographic aspect is that Yeah, we now have all these kids now. They're maybe first, second generation kids whose parents came here in the last 10, 20 years. And, you know, that gives us people that we wouldn't have had before. We would have had a shrinking child population rather than a growing child population. And that puts in a different situation than some European countries, which are growing quite, which are aging quite rapidly. But then there's the historical part of it. We have a history in this country of being a melting pot country. You know, there was a period, say, between 1925 and 1965 where we didn't have a lot of immigration to the United States due to the Depression, due to World War II, due to a lot of sort of nativist attitudes, frankly, in the United States during that time. But, you know, since 1965, when the immigration law was changed to open up the United States to more countries, and especially in the last 25 years, we've had a lot of immigration to the United States. And what it is it installs our, you know, historic value of being a melting pot nation and being accepting of people from other parts of the world. A lot of European countries, you know, are very strictly a particular ethnic background is what's central to their nature. If you're in France, you're French. If you're in German, you know, you're German, and you've many, many generations going way back. And I think some of those countries have a little more difficulty accepting people from other countries because they've been so generation after generation, the same values, the same customs, not being infused with different influences like we have been in the United States. And I think that helps us too, not only helps us in terms of the numbers, but also just being more inclusive, and also helping us to be able to communicate with other parts of the world. Now that we have a global economy, I think the fact that you have people here that can speak two or three different languages, that are capable of you know, interchange with folks of different backgrounds all the time, that's just part of their nature. That will be a big advantage for us going further.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Dylan on the line in Fort Worth. Hello, Dylan.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thanks.
All right, so just to kind of speak to the meaningfulness of this conversation, I am a 23-year-old white male. I'm dating an African-American girl. And I was just thinking, hypothetically, the funny thing is her mom is actually half white, half black. And so if we had children, they'd be technically more white than black. But I think a lot of the times with biracial children, they tend to either identify as one or the other. And so I was just thinking about the logistics of, you know, if hypothetically a child of ours would be applying for a scholarship that was only accessible to an African American, you know, what would the logistics of that be as we approach sort of the singularity point of all races?
I don't know if Bill's interested in giving scholarship advice, but what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting question, and what it does is it sort of points to the fact we're in a situation in this country where things are going to become much more fluid in terms of how we identify different racial groups. You know, the idea that we have these regulations and laws about who can qualify for certain kinds of scholarships and so forth by the way they classify themselves, that will have to be broadened a lot more and thought about a lot more, because any classification that we come up with, and the one we're using now are, you know, a little bit dated, doesn't keep up with the times. And so, you know, I think that obviously it's a rational thing to do, to think about how you're going to classify yourself. It's going to get you some benefits one way or another. But I think those classification systems are absolutely going to change, as there are going to be more people in the situation of the caller, because, you know, it's just a lot more complicated than it used to be.
I was thinking about the term melting pot, which you use in the book. And for a while, melting pot fell out of favor and people said, well, ideally, America is a tossed salad, these sort of pockets of people who are different and come from different traditions, but go along together well. And I suppose part of the melting pot phenomenon may come from the fact that there are so many interracial relationships now and children born from them who are not the same as carrots and lettuce in a tossed salad.
Yeah, you know, I think both of those categories, the salad bowl and the melting pot, are two kinds of extremes, and we're somewhere in between in the United States, because even though if you look at the national numbers, you say we have so many Hispanics and so many blacks and so many Asians and so forth, when you look to a certain community or a metropolitan area or a state, those numbers change in very different proportions, and that those intermarriages will change in very different proportions. So I think we're going to wind up having kind of multiple melting pots, depending which part of the country you live in. You know, I don't think we're eventually going to move into one homogeneous kind of classification for people, but I think people will value their backgrounds, and that will help us in lots of ways, having people who really identify with different backgrounds, with the different strengths of those cultural backgrounds. That's part of what makes this country good, not that everybody will sort of become one homogeneous type of person.
Let's speak now with Terry in Fort Worth. Hi, Terry.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Fry, you paint a rather rosy picture demographically for the United States. But there are other commentators who paint a very starkly different view. You have just finished stating that the period of immigration from 1925 to 1965 is a kind of dark ages for diversity. Someone like Pat Buchanan would say that's actually a golden era, and that these new groups are bringing culture alien to what is basically and fundamentally American. And secondly, you haven't addressed at all the issue of the generally falling IQ associated with these other groups.
Bill, do you want to go there?
Well, you know, it's true. There are these people who thought that was the golden age of America when we didn't have a lot of immigration. We did have, of course, a good economy. One thing we had were a lot of babies in the 1950s and a growing population of families, and it was not an old population. It was a young population. Now, this century, we're fortunate again to have a younger population, although because of the fact that we have these new minorities here, and I think that will help our vitality as well. I don't want to be too rosy about things because we do have a lot of inequality, income inequality, inequality in wealth and lots of other ways between whites and blacks, between whites and Hispanics. But what I do think is that when people see the nature of this huge demographic transformation, and it's not going to be stopped, as I said before, future immigration isn't going to change it that much. And they see that we really do need to depend on this next generation and next several generations to be able to move into the labor force, to move into the middle class in order to make the country more productive, in order to support the older white population, older largely white population, older population of all colors. They will understand why it's so important to invest in these young people and why they're really a gift to this country, because otherwise we would be in a situation where we would be stagnating demographically and stagnating economically. So, you know, it's the 21st century. It's not the 20th century anymore.
Any particular data point? We just have a few seconds left that you will be looking at very closely when the results of the 2020 census are released.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm going to be going to see how more dispersed the minority populations are across different parts of the country. You know, if we went back to 1990 or even 2000, a large share of the Hispanic population and the Asian population were in states like Texas and California and New York and Florida and New Jersey. But by the time the 2010 census came along, there was a lot of dispersion into the middle part of the country. I'm expecting that to be even more so with the 2020 census. So even more people are going to come in contact with this new America.
The new book by William H. Fry is called Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Bill, thank you so much for making this time for us.
I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts and Joe Cazera and Eric Bright. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.